Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. Majlis is the Arabic word for an assembly, literally a gathering of people sitting together, and it was used for the sessions of learned scholars, philosophers, intellectuals, and artists brought together to discuss and debate. Our podcast intends to accomplish the same purpose of bringing together experts and scholars for discussion and conversation about the politics, histories, cultures of the Middle East, Islamic world, and Muslim diasporas.
You can find the Majlis on your favorite podcast site, including Spotify and Apple iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think by giving us a rating.
Salam, hello, bonjour. Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project here at Queen's University. I'm your host, Adnan Hussein, director of MSGP and historian of the medieval Mediterranean and Islamic world. I'm really delighted today to be joined by Dr. Jean Rhys Bajalan, an associate professor at Missouri State University in their history department. Jean is a modern Middle East historian specializing in the rise of nationalism and the evolution of the Kurdish question. He's also a co-host of a really great podcast and YouTube show, This Is Revolution, that I really recommend to all listeners. Jean, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a real honor to be here with you again. I always enjoy everything you do as well, and I really appreciate having this opportunity to talk about the Kurdish movement in Iran and Absolutely. The current events taking place.
Absolutely. Well, that's indeed why I wanted to invite you on. I mean, we have a tradition at MSGP of doing sort of teach-ins, the Middle East and Islamic world update events related to contemporary current affairs in the Middle East and giving backgrounders to students and the public. And this just seemed like an absolutely perfect opportunity because you recently wrote a very interesting and important article for Jacobin magazine titled "The Kurdish Struggle is at the Heart of the Protests in Iran." Maybe, you know, as we get started, you could just briefly set the stage and summarize. I'm sure many of our listeners have been following these protests, but you know, what sparked these protests? And then we can talk a little bit more about your analysis in this article.
Sure. So these protests were triggered by the death in custody of Jina Amini, who was a Kurd from Iran, from a small town called Sakkas, who was visiting the capital city, Tehran. She was picked up by the Ishadi, the guidance police, the morality police, which is an arm of the state apparatus responsible for ensuring that people, primarily women, conform to the dress codes of the Islamic Republic in public. You know, and often this centers around the hijab, the Islamic headdress, the Islamic covering, and the state basically picked her up for having inappropriate head covering. And she was, as far as we know, she was beaten severely in police custody and subsequently collapsed, fell into a coma, and died 3 days after falling into that coma. And the state, of course, has tried to cover this up. They said, oh, you know, she had a pre-existing medical condition. She died because of that. You know, she wasn't beaten. They released some footage showing her passing out in the police station. But, you know, a lot of people this resonated with people in Iran. The protests began in the Kurdish region of the country and then spread to the rest of the country, you know, because obviously this issue of, you know, the state's attempts to govern women's bodies, how they dress in public, that resonates with, you know, people across Iran, not just the Kurdish community. Mm-hmm. So basically, we've had an outbreak of protests across the country. At the vanguard of these protests have been the Kurdish community, and also more generally, Iranian women, especially young women, who chafe under the strictures of the Islamic Republic and its peculiar interpretation of what appropriate Muslim behavior is, and its utilization of the modern apparatus of the state to enforce a particular interpretation of what it is to be a good Muslim in public.
Yes, well, thank you for that kind of characterization and summary of the events so far. As we know, these have been very widespread protests all over the country, but of course, as you mentioned, centered most intensely in Kurdish regions of the country. And they've gone global. Like, you know, people have been expressing solidarity in various ways all across the world, but, you know, a lot, of course, for our audience in North America and Europe. At the start of this essay, this article, in addition to talking about the events, you did talk a little bit about the reception of these events and how they've also, of course, been the subject of various kinds of solidarity. I wondered, you characterized some of this as a question of intersectional imperialism. And so before we go into really analyzing the whole history of it, I wondered if you wanted to comment a little bit more on, you know, the way in which this has been seized upon by people, by groups who are, you know, justifiably very outraged at this, you know, horrible event, and yet at the same time to take a principled position and a clear analysis. We have to make some broader distinctions here that you do in the article.
Sure. So perhaps I can begin, you know, we're talking about like various reactions that we see in the West. So, for example, you have a coterie of individuals who we might call anti-imperialists, who are suspicious of any kind of protest movement within a country that is opposed to the United States of America. So Iran is a country that, you know, has a long history of conflict with the United States, you know, is often seen in a positive light by certain elements of the so-called anti-imperialist community. And basically these people, you know, to put it simply, they kind of, I guess they read Chomsky, Said, a few other books, maybe a little bit of Fanon. And then rather than really challenging the kind of American exceptionalism, you know, America, the indispensable nation, you know, America is a good nation. Instead of challenging that kind of worldview, they merely inverted it, which leads them to, you know, critique anti-imperialism, sometimes correctly so, but also very often to dismiss any kind of protest movement as being some kind of CIA conspiracy. So there are, you know, it's kind of American exceptionalism, except, you know, America has all this power. It can reshape the world to its will. You know, that's what, you know, American imperialists believe. They believe that thing. Well, these anti-imperialists believe the same thing. It's just that they see it as a bad thing. And so they end up, you know, taking the narrative of the Islamic Republic, which is a right-wing capitalist state dominated by a capitalist oligarchy and a military industrial complex of its own, take that for granted. But then, of course, we have on the flip side, various forces, and this is a far more mainstream in the United States, who, for a variety of different reasons, will, you know, make progressive arguments for imperial intervention. And of course, this is nothing new. You know, when we talk about the history of imperialism, you know, often we focus on, you know, racial ideology, white supremacy, culture superiority, religious superiority complexes as well. But liberalism too has also played a role in justifying imperialism. You know, you go back to British colonial rule in India and the outlawing of widow burning, as providing a moral justification. And of course, progressive liberalism increasingly has become an important ideology in mobilizing the American population behind imperial projects. So the war in Afghanistan became a war to liberate women. And of course, this is seized on by different elements within the American political establishment, you know, whether that's liberals who forward this kind of humanitarian intervention idea of American imperial power, or it's neoconservatives who see, you know, talk about, you know, spreading democracy or whatever. It's functionally the same ideology. Sometimes it's framed more in a kind of anti-Muslim bigotry. Sometimes it's framed in a kind of bourgeois liberal feminism as well. And of course, there are elements within the American state apparatus, political class, as well as the broader media and think tank infrastructure that seek to justify particular policies through appeals to progressive liberal values. We've seen this in the Ukraine war, where, you know, if you push this narrative in the Ukraine context just a little bit, it kind of falls to pieces. But, you know, the idea of, you know, a progressive liberal Ukraine versus a reactionary Russia, which, you know, I'm not making any statements as to the rights or the wrong of the war, but of course, in both sides of the war, you have right-wing forces playing extremely important roles in the respective military campaigns. But you build up a kind of liberal narrative. So, and for the left in particular, this is often conditioned under the rubric of anti-fascism. So, you know, Iran, Russia, enemies of the United States, come to be remade as fascist powers. Sorry, that's my daughter. Internally, the enemies of progressive liberalism come to be framed as fascists as well. And this becomes a kind of ideology for, you know, voting for the Democratic Party. So we end up with this kind of intersectional imperialism, as I coined it, just because, you know, it is focusing on progressive issues to justify broader imperial projects.
Right. And of course, this is all happening in the context of, well, there's, of course, a long history of hostility and rivalry and sanctions on Iran and so on. And of course, we are amidst a period where the negotiations to possibly resurrect some form of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, have been discussed over the summer and apparently run aground. So this is a kind of framing context that might, you know, inform some of the responses institutionally and officially. But I think most of the responses, of course, principled solidarity with, you know, freedom for women. And as you point out in your article, really needs to be understood very much through the lens of Kurdish struggles for justice, the national question in Iran. For our listeners, perhaps you could first situate the Kurds in the Middle East, and then more specifically in Iran, and what that kind of struggle you know, has looked like, and how the Kurdish nationalism has developed in the context of post-colonial nationalisms in the Middle East.
Sure. So the Kurdish community are a people group in the Middle East. They reside by and large within a contiguous territory, which today stretches from, you know, northwestern Iran through northern Iraq, into parts of northern Syria, and then into Turkey, into southeastern Turkey. Historically, this region has been called Kurdistan, but of course that has overlapped with other toponyms, Armenia, Assyria, etc. So it's a territory which is largely mountainous, but includes, you know, pasture grounds, and historically was quite diverse. It included, you know, Kurds were one element of the population. You also had Assyrian Christians, you had Armenians, as well as, you know, communities of Arabs, Turks, Persians, many of which have lived there for a long time. So it's important to understand, you know, this is a diverse region. Like many mountainous regions in the world, it became, you know, it's a kind of refuge for communities avoiding state power. Right. So we have this mountainous region that Kurds call Kurdistan. And of course, over the course of the 19th and 20th century, with the rise of sectarian and religious conflicts in the Middle East, you know, there was an enormous amount of violence. Many of the minority groups were displaced or murdered. Most famously, we have the Armenian genocide of the First World War, which eliminated large parts of the Armenian community. So going into the 20th century, this region was more homogeneously Kurdish than it had been historically. But in the for a variety of different reasons, at the end of the First World War, you know, the Kurds did not achieve statehood. Kurdish nationalists, although lobbying for some form of autonomy or statehood in the post-World War I era, were unsuccessful. And the Kurdish homeland was repartitioned between Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And although it's a little bit more complicated than that, because, you know, parts of the Kurdish region had been under Iranian rule, you know, before the First World War, you know. But what happens is you have the emergence of more vigorous nation states that seek to impose a more unified national identity in all these countries in the 20th century, and the emergence of a Kurdish movement in each of these countries, an organizationally distinct Kurdish movement in each of these countries to fight for Kurdish national rights and national self-determination. Although what form that self-determination has been forwarded as has differed from period to period. Very rarely have Kurds called for full national independence or the creation of a pan-Kurdish state. In general, the demands of the Kurdish movement have been far more moderate, usually for some kind of autonomy or self-rule or cultural and educational rights and things like that. So we should be aware that when we talk about the Kurdish movement, and I prefer to use the word Kurdish movement to the word Kurdish nationalism. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the Kurdish movement, it's a diverse movement, which is not just about separatism. That's often how it's portrayed by the nation states within which they reside, but is a broad, you know, which is mobilizing around a broader question of, you know, are the Kurds a nation? If they're a nation, what are the political implications of that? And how and on whose terms can the Kurdish community achieve modernity and the good life and a peaceful existence? And, you know, some have argued for Kurdish independence and statehood, but by and large, the Kurdish movement in Iran, in Turkey, in Iraq, and in Syria has often had more moderate demands. Than that. So the Iranian Kurds are, you know, one part of a broader Kurdish political and cultural community in the Middle East.
Right. And they are, however, a pretty substantial minority population in Iran.
Yes. It's hard. Well, in Iran, it's difficult to come up with precise numbers for the ethnic background of people in Iran. You know, the statistics are not taken in that way. Many people have hybrid backgrounds or have, you know, hybrid identities. But, you know, usually you'll hear a number between, you know, 8% and 15% of the population. But one of the things that slightly diffuses the national question in Iran is that Iran is really still a multinational polity in many ways. The Persian-speaking community is certainly the dominant community, but you have a powerful and large Azerbaijani-Turkish community that is very well integrated into the economy and into the elites. And you have other communities that have, you know, perhaps even greater national grievances against the Iranian central government, such as the Baluchi population who live in the south, east of the country. You also have a large Arab minority in the southwest of the country. So Iran is a diverse multinational empire. And, you know, for some, the Iranian identity is a kind of encompassing identity that is supra-ethnic, you know, above the Persian, Turkish, Kurdish, Baluchi identity, everybody's Iranian. But one of the contradictions of the Iranian nation-building project in the 20th century has been, as the state has sought to forge a unified Iranian identity, this is often elided, you know, Persian cultural traditions and mores with a kind of broader Iranian identity. So, you know, in reaction to this, some groups, some communities have rejected the Iranian identity, or at least want some kind of reformulation of the Iranian identity in a more inclusive way. So, you know, Iranian state discourse is often, you know, bestowed the title of Iranian on people, but the people, groups like the Kurds will be like, well, if we're Iranians, why don't we get the same cultural privileges, the same political and cultural rights as the Persian community does? So there's a kind of contradiction in the discourse, but the concept of an Iranian identity is somewhat, you know, flexible in a certain sense, and, you know, at various periods has had more purchase amongst the Kurdish community, and at times less purchase amongst the Kurdish community.
Right. And I wonder also if maybe you could comment a little bit more on some of the contradictions of that might arise also because of the Iranian revolution itself. So, you know, the establishment of the, you know, Islamic Republic of Iran, obviously, in much the same way that Persian identities kind of become normative as the assumed dominant national kind of ethno-linguistic identity, that Shi'i Islam is also the dominant religious tradition, and that, you know, most Kurds are, I believe, Sunni. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. So there are important communities of Kurds who are Shia, especially in the region of Kermanshah, spreading across the border into Iraq in Khanaqin, where you have largely Shia Kurdish populations, but the vast majority of Kurds are Sunni Muslims. And of course, that meant with the formation of a Shia state, there was a sectarian issue that had previously not existed, you know, within the secular framework of Pahlavi era nationalism. So the Islamic Republic reformulated an Iranian identity and moved it away from a kind of secular pre-Islamic version of Iranian identity towards one that very much embraced the Shia tradition of the country as a basis for national unity. But of course, for Sunni communities, Kurds and Baluch, for example, you know, that was an exclusionary identity as well. So even as the Iranian identity has reformulated under the Islamic Republic, there's still been a kind of contradictions with the Kurdish community in Iran.
Mm. Yeah, and I was interested also in the long history that you do detail, maybe not at great length, and now is an opportunity if there's more detail than you had in the article, but the various different phases of resistance to the Iranian state. And you pointed out that even in 1947, there was a brief period of a small independent polity that didn't survive very long, but that's sort of the start. If, you know, people, you know, should appreciate that, you know, some sort of sense of the desire for autonomy in various forms has taken shape over different phases. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about, you know, Kurdish responses within Iran to, the national government or the formation of a nation state.
Sure. So we can actually trace this back to the late 19th century. You know, prior to the mid 19th century, both Ottoman and Iranian control over Kurdistan had largely been exercised through vassals, tribal vassal zones, tribal polities, vassal kingdoms, some of which were quite large and powerful. For example, the city of Sanandaj, which is the center of a resistance to the Iranian state today, was historically the capital of the Ardalanid principality, which, you know, existed for several centuries and was a center of Kurdish culture and literary production. There were other Kurdish kingdoms, most of which were loyal to the Ottoman state, but there were some like the Ardalanids who generally inclined towards Qajars, and before them the Safavids, etc. So it was only in the 19th century that we see, at least on an administrative and political sense, attempts to centralize both the Ottoman and Iranian empire. So Kurdistan is transformed from being a zone of petty kingdoms over which imperial powers play a kind of balancing act, trying to win over supporters. That's transformed. The autonomy of Kurdish princes is repressed most successfully in the Ottoman Empire, but also in Iran. But in Iran, the process is more lethargic. The process of administrative and political centralization is slower, less complete. And then, you know, in the late 19th century, there is a major tribal uprising, the Sheikh Ubaidullah revolt, which is launched against both the Iranian and Ottoman state. And it's a tribal rebellion, but we have to understand that nationalism isn't simply an ideology that develops from within communities, but it's a global ideology on which people draw. So, you know, even if this rebellion had kind of millenarial religious origins, in terms of how Sheikh Ubaidullah justified this, he adopted that new language of nationalism, because nationalism was increasingly an ideology that was framing international affairs and international relations. And of course, we see subsequent to that, various other tribal leaders, such as Simcoe Shekac in the early 20th century, adopting the vocabulary of nationalism to frame their resistance to the central state. So that's so we have an earlier phase, especially in Iran, where tribes adopt nationalism as an ideological weapon through which to resist the state. In fact, it often serves as a kind of common framework for intellectuals and tribal groups to work together, you know, even though they have different, you know, ideological and sociological orientation, nationalism provides a common framework. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would argue that, you know, for much of the 20th century, the functional role of Kurdish nationalism was as a rubric under which, urban elites and tribal communities who have different reasons for opposing the nation state in these countries provided a rubric under which they could operate together. Mm. We see this, you know, in the early Kurdish uprisings in Turkey, such as the Sheikh Said revolt, where you have sort of modern educated military officers working alongside Sufi elites. You see this most, you know, clearly in Iraq with the emergence of the Kurdistan Democratic Party of Iraq in the post-World War II era, where you have a political party that brings together, tribal elements resisting the Iraqi central state and resisting land reform, and urban elites who are alienated by Arabization and the suppression of Kurdish languages and culture. Nationalism provides a rubric under which these groups can function together. Mm-hmm. So in Iran, we have this first phase of nationalism, which is largely where nationalism, where it does appear, is kind of used by tribal leaders to assert their privileges and their autonomy over the region. But 1947, obviously, is a critical moment because we have the establishment of the Mahabad Republic, which is an autonomous republic centered on the town of Mahabad, which is in the province of Western Azerbaijan. Western Azerbaijan is parts of it are predominantly Kurdish. And this republic is established within the context of the Anglo-Soviet occupation of the country. So, the periphery of the Iranian state had largely been brought under control in the early 20th century with the rise of the Pahlavi dynasty. Under the Qajar dynasty in the 19th century, the process of centralization had been kind of slow, but under Pahlavi, it picks up and there is kind of a military reconquest of the country. But this falls to bits in the Second World War when the Shah of Iran, Reza Shah, is viewed by the Soviets and by the British as being too cozy with Hitler. Mm-hmm. Iran is critical to the supply of the Soviet war effort. So the two countries invade Iran, and the whole apparatus of the state suddenly unravels. And one of the outcomes of this is in Azerbaijan, Iranian Azerbaijan, there is an autonomous republic declared, and then with Soviet backing. And then there is in Mahabad, you see the emergence of a Kurdish autonomous republic led by Qazi Muhammad, who was a kind of, he's an urban intellectual. And they begin this sort of 11-month process of attempting to govern themselves and establish their authority and engage in some kind of progressive reforms. And this is a critical moment, not just for Iran, but also for Iraqi Kurdistan, because some Kurdish nationalists, as well as tribal leaders, most notably Mullah Mustafa Barzani, who would go on to lead the Kurdistan Democratic Party of Iraq, for a variety of reasons, they get in trouble with the Iraqi government, and they flee across the border to Mahabad as well. And it's at Mahabad we see the formation of the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which is originally one party. It's called the Kurdistan Democratic Party because they adhered to socialist doctrines that prior to the socialist revolution, they must achieve the national democratic revolution. So, it was the Kurdistan Democratic Party. Originally, the Iraqi Kurdistan Democratic Party was supposed to be a branch of the main Kurdish Democratic Party in Iran. But, over time, these two parties became distinct political parties. Mullah Mustafa, when the republic was crushed, he fled to the Soviet Union. Qazi Muhammad was executed. And eventually there's two Kurdistan Democratic Parties that come out of this. The Iranian one, which tends in a more kind of left nationalist direction. And the Iraqi one, which for a time adheres to a kind of left nationalism, but increasingly becomes more and more conservative over time. But they originate in this kind of experiment of Kurdish self-rule at the end of the First World War, which is eventually crushed. Now, on the Iranian Kurdish movement in between this period and the Iranian Revolution, there's an excellent book by Professor Abbas Vali, one of the few people who has really looked at this in a detailed way. We see the percolation of various ideas amongst the Kurdistan Democratic Party. We see the emergence of a more radical Kurdish left manifest in the formation of Komala, which was a more explicitly socialist political formation that that tended to do very well in the regions around Sanandaj, which is in Kurdistan province, whereas the Kurdistan Democratic Party did better in the more conservative regions around Mahabad in Western Azerbaijan province. But basically, we see the emergence of a Kurdish movement during this period. The Iranian state in this period, at least up until the White Revolution, is relying on basically the support of tribal groups to maintain its authority. This is quite ironic considering the hostility there was towards tribal groups in the early history of the Pahlavi regime. But, when we get to this period, even in the crushing of the Mahabad Republic, they make use of, you know, Kurdish tribal groups to assist them in this. So we basically have a kind of situation where nationalist ideas continue to percolate during this region, during this era. You know, the Iranian government, for example, is funding the Kurdish insurgency in Iraq. Many Iranian Kurds join that insurgency. So there's a kind of porous interaction across the border. So Kurdish national consciousness in Iraq, as it consolidates, also impacts on Iran. And, you know, eventually in the struggle against the Shah, the Kurds play a significant role in that struggle, or they place a part in it. And then significantly, once the Shah is gone, the Kurds, Kurdish groups are some of the first to, you know, resist the Islamist hijacking of the revolution. Kurdistan becomes like a battleground for the consummation of the Islamic Republic. This is a kind of common theme, I would say, in the countries that Kurds reside, is that the consolidation of authoritarian regimes in these countries is often, you know, built on war in Kurdistan, whether this is in Turkey and whether this is in Iran. Mm-hmm. Now, the Kurdish armed struggle in Iran continues, obviously, in the context of the Iran-Iraq war. Iran is supporting the Iraqi Kurds. Iraq is supporting the Iranian Kurds. But when the war comes to an end, basically, the armed struggle, the Iranian-Kurdish armed struggle comes to an end. Most of the KDP Iran and the Komala, they have to go to Iraqi Kurdistan or they go to Europe. In Iraqi Kurdistan, you know, especially after the 1991 Kurdish uprising and the formation of the autonomous Kurdish administration there, basically the Iranian government and the Kurdish administration have a kind of tacit agreement. It's like, okay, we won't attack these guys, but you have to make sure that they can't attack into Iran as well. You know, at times the Iranians have fired rockets at these camps, but they by and large just large villages where people, you know, engage in like a military exercise now and again, but there aren't like ongoing cross-border operations. So in the late 80s, early 90s, the kind of armed struggle phase comes to an end. And in fact, the Iranian state engages in a kind of state terrorism, even in Europe, murdering the leader of the Kurdistan Democratic Party in Austria, Abdulrahman Hasanlu, murdering other leaders of the Kurdish movement in Germany, you know, really sowing fear amongst these people. So that kind of phase comes to an end in the 80s and 90s. But a new phase begins, and largely directed in civil society within Iran, within the context of the reform movement in the late 1990s, which opens up opportunities for Kurdish reformist candidates to enter the Iranian parliament, although that's kind of clamped down on.
Yeah, I thought that was quite interesting that, I mean, that isn't often included in discussions of, you know, Khatami's reform movement and successful, you know, electoral strategy there, at least to achieve, you know, success in being, you know, elected there, that Kurdish, this was an opening in some ways also for Kurdish politicians advocating for more cultural rights and so forth. Part of that sort of reform includes, you know, some kind of change in policy toward these ethno-linguistic and religious minorities in Iran. Fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, Kurdistan has been a reliable pro-reform region in Iran. And of course, you know, you have I wouldn't call it like democratic in the fullest sense of the word, but you have some kind of elite competition within the Islamic Republic. There are factions and they engage in some kind of politics. The problem is that this kind of trajectory, this possible trajectory of liberalization is always clamped down
right
on what we might call the Iranian deep state, which is the kind of constellation of clerical organizations, business interests linked to the Islamic Republic, as well as the security services, which have enormous, you know, economic and political and military power across the country. And of course, this is, you know, embodied in the supreme leader, who is not elected. And whenever the elected branch of the Iranian government gets a little bit too big for its boots, it gets stamped down on. And there's been this trend of kind of opening and then a kind of reaction. But each time the reaction happens in Iran, you know, the credibility of reform as a mode for change in Iran becomes increasingly discredited. 2009 obviously was a critical moment in that point with the Green Movement. But, you know, also, you know, we see the election of Raisi recently. You know, people about 50, maybe even lower than that, lower than 50% of people turn out to vote, whereas previously you have like 70, right. 80% turnout. Right. People don't really trust the regime. A lot of the leaders of the reform movement, they've either compromised themselves or they're under house arrest. So you have this kind of now the the regime is really in the hands of the a more cohesive hardline faction, which has in many ways benefited from the conflict with the United States.
Right.
In that, you know, obviously that totally discredits the reform movement and their desire to open up the country, and also, you know, creates a perpetual economic crisis that this kind of parasitical elite can get rich in, right? You know, yeah. If you have connections to the state, you can get cheap dollars. Mm-hmm. You can get a visa to Canada. And Canada is one of the worst offenders for allowing these regime people to come and live it up. They are able to buy up properties, real estates from an increasingly impoverished general Iranian population and you know, make themselves, you know, and bourgeois themselves, you know,
right. Get wealthy. I mean, the effect of these, you know, very extreme sanctions regime is to orient privilege in a very narrow way, because some people are still going to find ways to profit from the loopholes or the other opportunities that are available. It's
all
just that the general population is not going to have access to those avenues, you know.
Exactly. And those in the general population that do have properties and businesses, they have to sell them up as the conditions become more desperate, you know. So you have this hardline element that thrives off the conflict with the United States as well, coming to power, and an increasingly frustrated and despondent population that is fed up of this regime for for a variety of different economic, political, and cultural reasons. Now, in the Kurdish area, those general reasons are supplemented with particular national grievances. And some elements of the, you know, even of the Iranian opposition like to downplay these things. They like to say, no, you're just hijacking it for Kurdish nationalist reasons, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's like, it's important to recognize there are specific national grievances, while at the same time pointing out that that doesn't necessarily mean Kurds want to secede from Iran. It just, you know, it's pointing out there are specific problems in the Kurdish area on top of the general problems that affect all Iranians. You know, there is a kind of, Kurdistan is relatively underdeveloped. Kurds are more heavily policed by the Iranian state. And, you know, there is restrictions on Kurdish language and culture, which is an enormous frustration to the local population. So, you know, the slogans are often nationalist ones, but even in the nationalist ones, one has to bear in mind that, you know, and this is important for people to understand, and I always reiterate this, no major Kurdish political party in Iran, even the Mahabad Republic, all the way back in 47, has called for complete secession and independence from Iran. The slogan has generally been autonomy for Kurdistan, democracy in Iran. That's an important thing to understand. One shouldn't obfuscate the peculiar and particular demands of the Kurdish community within the overall opposition in Iran, while at the same time, one shouldn't assume that Kurdish national consciousness is coergent with a desire for the formation of an independent Kurdish nation state on the territory of Iran. The reality is between those two things, where Kurds want to exercise national self-determination. They want to define their relationship with the Iranian core, rather than having the core always telling them how they are allowed to define that relationship. And, you know, one of the problematic tendencies I see from Persians is always a preoccupation of either downplaying the peculiar national question in Iran and complaining that you're sowing division. My mm-hmm. argument would be is that by refusing to recognize these peculiarities, you are in fact the ones who are making Kurds polarize. You're buying into the state narrative, which has always been to portray any manifestation of Kurdish cultural, political distinctiveness as separatism. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a redefining of these relationships, and Kurds should have an ability, and there'll be many different opinions within the Kurdish community, but they should be able to define how they want their relationship to be with the core of the Iranian state.
Yes, I mean, I think this is a really important point, and I think also just to come back to the article, you started to discuss there sort of the prospects for how this recent protest movement may be able to articulate a platform or a political program that really straddles and gets that balance correct. You know, this is, of course, in one major respect, you know, about personal freedom, about, you know, the desire for women's rights and the ability for them to express themselves rather than be targets of patriarchal repression. And at the same time, because this was a Kurdish young woman who was victimized in this way, that taps into, you know, a variety of other sources of particular dissent and concerns, that somehow some kind of integration of those has to take place. And I think you pointed out in the article that there were possibilities perhaps to take some inspiration from some of the other Kurdish movements that have been sophisticated in their political orientation, something you called democratic confederalism. I'm wondering if maybe you could elaborate a little bit on what that looks like. You mentioned it as anarchism, eco-socialism, and women's liberation as these kind of key foundational planks, and the current slogans for women, life, and freedom. You coordinated those as perhaps positively drawing some inspiration from that kind of a politics.
Yeah, so you know, because the Iranian Kurds are part of a broader Kurdish political field, which is superimposed on Iran and connects, you know, Kurdish communities in all the parts of Kurdistan, there's a certain cross-pollination of ideas between various groups. You know, as I said, you know, the Kurdistan Democratic Party of Iraq, mm-hmm. which is the dominant party in Iraq today, has its roots in the Mahabad Republic. The former president of Iraqi Kurdistan, Masoud Barzani, was not born in Iraq. He was born in Mahabad. He was born during the years of the Mahabad Republic. And of course, there is an ideological interchange as well. And we've seen the growth of the Kurdistan Workers' Party and the shift in the Kurdistan Workers' Party, better known as the PKK in Turkey, as well as the formation of a broader Kurdish movement. You know, I think this is often ignored because there is somewhat of a cult of personality around the imprisoned leader of the PKK, yeah. Abdul Öcalan. But a broader Kurdish movement in Turkey, you know, particularly around the HDP party and Saladin Demirtas, you know, this broader movement that has, you know, really emphasized the women's question. Of course, this comes from the writings of Öcalan, but also lots of women activists. The PKK always recruited heavily amongst women. In fact, the PKK was often a way for women in rural Kurdish society to escape patriarchy in a way that was honorable, where the sexual honor would be maintained and they wouldn't have, you know, they couldn't be criticized from within the community. And of course, you know, I'm not what I would say supporters of the PKK and the various forces aligned with the PKK. They call it the Kurdish Freedom Movement. I'm not aligned with their ideology particularly, but I think what's kind of interesting about the development of their ideology is that they have moved away from a kind of traditional notion of what a Kurdish autonomy would look like, which is what we might think of as a quasi-nation state. Very much what we see in Iraq, where you have like a flag, a parliament, you're not a sovereign state. There are certain aspects of sovereignty you don't have, but by and large, you have your own autonomous region, something like Scotland, something like Quebec. I noticed at the beginning, you said bonjour to make sure the French Canadians would be not feel excluded.
Right.
In this predominantly Anglo country. So, you know, there's this traditional notion of autonomy as a kind of like quasi-nation state. The PKK constellation has moved away from that towards notions of radical local government, municipal government, organizing things on a municipal level with various different kind of popular councils and things like that. And basically explicitly rejecting the notion of a quasi-nation state form of autonomy for a form of autonomy, which is, at least on paper, devolved to the lowest possible level. And to a certain degree, many of these ideas were implemented, or at least partially implemented, in northern Syria with the rise of the YPG and the PYD, the Kurdish political parties that have an ideological affinity with the PKK. And to a certain degree, these ideas have impacted Iranian Kurdistan. In 2004, a kind of wing of the PKK known as Pezhak was established in Iran. But, you know, like these ideas have kind of filtered through, you know, the news, through the kind of Kurdish political sphere. But they've resonated with not just Kurds, but Iranians, because I think one of the striking things about the PKK and its shift towards centering the women's struggle is that it actually makes a lot of political sense within the context of the Middle East, especially, you know, in the context of what we always talk about on This Is Revolution podcast, there's the 50-year counter-revolution, which in the Middle East, which has taken the form of either secular regimes increasingly capitulating to reactionary ideals and notions of patriarchy, or overt Islamist takeovers of countries. So it makes sense to center women as a revolutionary agent within this context, because this is a huge element of the population, which is disproportionately, carrying the burden of not only the general economic problems that these societies face, class oppression, but also have this added layer of patriarchy and, you know, reactionary legal and political regimes placed upon them. So the slogan developed by the PKK, woman, life, freedom, Jinjian, Azadi, has been rendered into Persian, Zan, Zindagi, Azadi. And, you know, it's resonated. It's a successful slogan, but not only because it kind of has a radical message, also because it's easily to appropriate. You know, you can read into that slogan radical anti-capitalism, but you could also read it as a kind of liberal feminist thing as well. So it's resonated as well. And I think, you know, that shows there's a kind of cross-pollination of ideas. But I also think what else is important, I think, you know, Kurds cannot in Iran achieve liberation by themselves, right? In general, Kurdish liberation in the Middle East cannot be achieved independent from the other national groups of the Middle East, you know. And what is positive is that this movement, you know, many Iranians are sympathetic to the plight of the Kurds. And, you know, hopefully out of these protests, which are kind of disorganized and don't have a clear leadership, there can be a program that isn't just kind of a universalism, you know, a kind of, you know, universal liberal rights, ignoring the specificities of women and national minorities, but can have a program that encompasses all of these issues. Because, you know, the women and minority rights are the canaries in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you know, once they start removing the rights of women and minorities, you'll be sure that your like basic bourgeois democratic rights will be not far behind us. So hopefully an opposition movement can truly become a multi-ethnic, multinational movement within Iran for a more inclusive, secular, democratic political order in the country. One that, you know, includes and resolves the national question in Iran definitively, and in such a way that, you know, that unity in Iran does not have to be achieved through coercive means, but is achieved through a voluntary, you know, union of peoples who respect each other.
Well, that's certainly a hopeful vision and a hopeful note on which to end on. This has been a really wonderful conversation. Gene, I have to thank you for giving us a real education in the history of Kurdish movements, particularly in Iran, and connecting them to the current situation in Iran, and reminding us so much about the tragedies and exclusions of nationalism, the way it's affected the Middle East, and also of the repressions of the nation state as a form. So hopefully in that hopeful vision, we see the seeds of a democratic realignment of these societies. How can people follow your work and learn about anything upcoming that they should look out for?
I guess you can look at my faculty page at Missouri State University. You can, of course, check out This Is Revolution podcast. It's in all the podcast places like Apple. We also have a YouTube channel. And, you know, I have things in Jacobin. I have academic articles on my academia. You can follow me on Twitter at Jean Bajalan, all one word. I usually am on there wasting time, like the worst of us. But yeah, you know, those are the places you can find me.
Terrific. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. It's been a lot of fun and very educational. So thank you so much for joining us on the Much List.
And thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure.
Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at Adnan A. Hussein, and I encourage you to follow the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project, get on our mailing list, our newsletter, notices of events. We have them both locally and also do like to stream them sometimes. So wherever you are, you could follow and attend, but also we put out this podcast and we have a YouTube channel where we put out videos of events that we don't live stream, but that happen in person. Do follow us on social media. You can go to www.queensu.ca/MSGP and find all the contact information, as well as self-enroll into the email newsletter list. Until next time, salam.
Thank you for joining us in the Mejlis, a podcast by MSGP. Muslim Society's Global Perspectives, or MSGP, is an initiative at Queen's University dedicated to connecting the complex history of Islamic societies with the contemporary world. You can connect, learn more, and support us by checking out our website, www.queensu.ca/MSGP, and stay up to date with our events by following us on Twitter at MSGPQU and on our Facebook, MSGPQU. You can also follow our YouTube channel, The Mejlis.